Conversations. That's 503-231-8187. Or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for joining us this morning.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, this is an important year. It's the 30th anniversary of Macintosh. It's the 575th anniversary of the Gutenberg Press. And it is the 115th birthday of Laszlo Biro, the inventor of the ballpoint pen.
That's right.
So I assume that all of those are changes in our technology which have caused people to get upset or worried about life will never be the same. Has the fear of technological advance always been a part of civilization, do you think?
Yeah, I think any technology that comes along that changes, particularly the way that we communicate, tends to freak us out, because there's something about communication that it's a uniquely human act, right? You know, it's the way we make sense of the world, and it's the way we learn about other people. And so every time you get a technology that changes the way we communicate, it changes the way we learn about each other, it changes the way we learn about the world, and it's really unsettling for a long time, sometimes decades and centuries. I mean, you know, like, really, if you went back in time, the very first sort of communications technology, disruption or moment of unsettling moment was writing, when writing became a new thing. I guess, you know, we're talking about back in the days of Socrates. You know, the ancient Greek culture was shifting from a purely oral culture where if you heard a wonderful speech, you had to commit as much of it as you could to memory, because they were really not much yet in the tradition of writing things down. That was something you did for commerce, but it wasn't really done for culture. But slowly people started writing speeches down in scrolls and trading them that way. And so Socrates, you know, he actually there's a Platonic dialogue called the Phaedrus, where Socrates sort of worries about what writing is going to do. And he says, it's going to reduce our memory. We're not going to memorize things anymore. And if we don't memorize things, then how can we be considered to really have wisdom? And he also worried that we would stop arguing with each other, that you know, that if I wrote something down and handed it to you, you'd walk off, you'd read it, it's all well and fine, but what if you decided that I was wrong? You couldn't argue with what was written down in the way that you could argue with me. And for him, this was the death of wisdom, because wisdom came forged in debate. So this stuff goes back. So these concerns, and I don't mean to dismiss these concerns. I mean, I think a lot of we really do lose certain things as technological progress goes along. We gain a lot, but there are things that are lost. And so each moment of disruption is something that we have to very carefully look at and try and figure out what are the things that we should try and optimize here, and if we're losing something, can we preserve any of it? That's the task of society.
One thing I think might be really interesting is to hear your definition for your title. What do you mean by smarter? Because there's different types of intelligence.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound like you're necessarily talking about our intelligence quotient.
Right,
necessarily,
right.
But you're talking about some different type of intelligence that in which we become smarter. Do you define that?
That's a really good question, because IQ is kind of a, you know, it's not a really good measure of intelligence. I mean, you know, we've learned over the years that these IQ measures, IQ tests, don't really capture what you mean by intelligence. So yes, it's a good question. What do I mean by smarter? Well, I take a very practical definition of it. Let's put it this way. What do I mean when I say thinking? You know. So I'm when I talk about thinking in my book, I talk about the practical stuff we do every day, which is how do we learn about the world? How do we sort of record it and keep notes and sort of, you know, like, organize our store of knowledge that's inside and outside of our heads? And thirdly, how do we talk to other people about it? How do we share and trade it and argue about it and act on it? So it's those three things. And so the reason why I think we are, by and large, we've been getting a lot smarter with our recent bursts of technology in the last 10 years is that it has it's given us fascinating new ways to do all those three venerable forms of thinking. We have We have new ways to learn about the world and the people around us. We have new ways to record and store and reference that information. And we have an enormously, explosively enlarged ability to sort of talk to other people and bounce ideas off people and think alongside people. I mean, I think in one respect, if you wanted to sort of put a 25 words or less explanation of my book, I think the current phase in technology, digital technology, computers, networked computers, it's made us into more social thinkers. It's allowed us to think more in tandem with other people, to learn more from other people, to talk with other people, to even use other people to help us remember and recall things. We've become more social thinkers, and this is a historic trend. It's we've been social thinkers for a long time, but it has become greatly amplified in delightful everyday ways.
So expand a little bit about that, because some people would argue, or I have heard argue, that this recent expansion in terms of technology has in fact rather made it more difficult to be social sure. people, creating an artificial or virtual communities.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's another long-standing concern that there's something. It's almost like the sort of Rousseau noble savage concept that we are only really human when we are standing before each other, you know, completely unmediated, and that every mode that gets in between us reduces that humanity. I frankly don't buy that. We're a very communicative species, and we've been very good at doing it in all sorts of modes and media that we've used, from writing and from letters and from books onwards. There's definitely fears you see about socializing that occur over and over again. When the telegraph came along, there was a huge, you know, sort of hope and hysteria that oh my goodness, this would unite humanity in a global brotherhood, and war would be over because we would be in contact with each other, and we would no longer be strangers to each other. And you know, to which Thoreau replied, on the other hand, we may just discover that we have absolutely nothing to say to each other. So there was a debate about that. He's like we hasten to build a telegraph from New York to Texas, but what if New York and Texas have absolutely nothing to say to one another, right? You know.
But there is a point to that. You know, when you stop and you think about the just flood of information that we're sending to each other that's really kind of meaningless or not as content rich as it should be. Not every tweet that comes out is rational. Sometimes we make mistakes in tweeting too much information that's still not usable.
You know, I disagree. I disagree because I think that you're judging the standards of a tweet on the standards of, say, a book, right? You're
saying not at all. I'm judging it on standards of it being valuable to us in terms of communicating something important. Now, you have a good point when you talk about we learn more about each other, but I also have seen people get in trouble by tweeting absolute nonsense or going on Facebook and tweeting absolutely, what would you call it? You call it social suicide. You know, you tell the absolute wrong things.
Well, sure. I mean, you're absolutely right. But this is the thing. This is itself not particularly new. I mean,
not at all. You're right.
Like what we're seeing online is what's happening is that conversation is becoming visible, right? Mm. So it used to be, you know, that we engage in tons and tons and tons of conversation, and we got ourselves in a lot of trouble with that conversation, and people said silly things, and they said smart things, and they said dull things, and they said deceptive things. But it was hard to see that conversation if you weren't around it. I think that the big shift now is that the conversation becomes visible, and so we can scrutinize it. And it's almost like when the invisible becomes visible, there's a shock to us as we realize, oh my goodness, this is what we're actually talking about. I have political friends of mine who've often said, you know, my God, I don't think people, you know, talk about politics enough. They don't, you know, like I look at the conversation of, you know, supposedly intelligent friends of mine, and they're just sort of talking about their day, and they're talking about, you know, I don't know, TV shows, and I feel like they should be talking more about politics. And I said to them, well, you know, let's take a look at everyday life. So how much do you think people talk about politics before the internet. Like, I was just walking down the street, and he said, I don't know, like, you know, 20% of the time. And I said, well, actually, Robin Dunbar, you know, the anthropologist who studies language, he back in the 80s, he dispatched grad students up and down the length of London and up and down the length of the UK to listen in, to eavesdrop on conversations for long periods of time and to figure out what is it that people actually talk about. And when he broke it down, he discovered that politics and religion put together, so those two subjects occupied 3% of what people talked about. Right, so it was an absolutely tiny fraction of everyday conversation. Now, you can actually make the argument that people should be more politically engaged. They should talk about it more often. Perfectly fair. But what my friend is reacting to when he looks online and he sees his friends, he thinks he should be talking about politics more. I say to him, no, they're talking about the same things they were talking about before. You just had an illusion in your head about the way society worked that has been disabused because now you can see it. So that thing. Now, the one thing I think that is true, that is different now, that is very different, and I think this is a significant issue and something that you hit on there, is the fact that when this conversation now can be, because it's recorded and is stored, it can come back and bite you in the butt months or years later. Mm-hmm. And this is, particularly with teenagers, this is a real problem because, you know, like, it's hard when you're 18 years old to imagine that 4 years from now, people are still going to care about what you said 4 years ago. And so there's been this problem that I think all of these tools were designed to store stuff forever. That has caused innumerable problems for people. Like, you're applying for a job and, you know, your boss finds this picture of you partying with red cups 4 years ago. Well, that's not who you are anymore, but it's still there. And so what we're seeing now, and this is really interesting, is the reaction to that, which is the emergence of chat tools that are specifically designed not to make things completely public and not to store them forever, to have them vanish after a little while. Sort of artificial forgetting. I actually think that is going to continue to be something we see a lot more of, because it reduces, it allows people to engage in the conversation that can be very powerful without it haunting them for the next 5 to 10 years of their lives.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland. We're speaking today with Clive Thompson, who is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. So I especially want to talk to our younger listeners out there who are more immersed, or even those who are older who are very much immersed in technology, to get your ideas. Do you feel the technology is making us smarter and more communicative? Or do you find that there are limits even to how useful technology is? And so give us a call, 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our first caller, Joel. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I had a question, a thought. I think I'm curious what you would think. It seems that questioning technology, Clive, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Okay. So, yeah, you said, you know, you mentioned questioning the benefits or, of technology, and sometimes we should save something if it's lost. But it seems to me, and I wonder what you think of this, that it is very much not questioned most of the time. Spectacle and amazement and even maybe some addictive qualities to lots of technologies will come around. I'm curious what you think. I would suppose, well, what's something that has been questioned by culture and then kind of thrown away, even though it was maybe some sort of, you know, very much a new technology, maybe very kind of fascinating or amazing? I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you for your call.
Yep.
You know, I think one area where we've seen some really good critiquing and appropriate criticism of modern technology was with the subject of distraction, right? So, I mean, if you go back and look, like, maybe 10 years ago or 12 years ago, the internet first comes along, there was, you know, people were kind of excited about the idea that you could quote unquote multitask. You know, you could sort of, you know, you could have a chat with someone while you were reading a website and while you're writing an email, and people felt, oh, I'm sort of being really, I'm operating operating at my cognitive peak here. I'm kind of getting all these things done,
and then we found we weren't.
Yes, exactly. You know, exactly. And then after a couple of years, you know, the research started showing, and people started noticing. Actually, I seem to be getting less done. You know, like, and I feel frazzled. I feel like a complete nightmare. And what started happening is we began to realize that, you know, just because these machines made it possible to do four completely different things at once, you know, did not mean that it was a good thing to do. And so more and more you're finding people realizing that multitasking, and actually it's almost a wrong word for it. It's called task switching. Switching from one totally different task to another totally different task, you know, every 15 seconds is a recipe for getting nothing done. And for nothing being stored in your head. So I've been seeing a lot of professionals, a lot of people, young and old, realizing that, you know, what they need to practice is kind of more like mindfulness of just, you know, paying attention to one thing at a time, doing one thing at a time. Because, you know, it's great that you can, that there's all these capabilities, but, you know, that hasn't changed our mental ability to really shine when we're focusing on one thing for a significant amount of time. And I've seen corporations installing cultures that encourage people to do less messaging so people can focus more. I've seen, you know, parents, you know, talking to their kids about it, and parents tackling their own sort of distracted habits. So this is a productive, really productive conversation that's emerged. But it took 5 years of like kind of us, you know, being kind of kept swept up, I guess, in the kind of excitement of it, to realize that this is a downside that we have to tackle, you know?
So since that might be a downside that we have to tackle, the myth of multitasking, other problems that people have talked about is the seemingly lack of interpersonal conversation. So you are in a park and everyone is looking at their smartphone, or you are in a restaurant and your date is texting somebody while you're doing the same thing.
Right. Here's my thoughts on that. First off, in any situation where people genuinely should be present and talking to one another, if they're not doing that, that is genuinely terrible. That needs to be addressed and called out and criticized vociferously. I totally believe that. That said, I think we are massively over exaggerating how often that happens, because every day I open up the newspaper and there's another op-ed saying, oh my god, I was in a restaurant and everyone was on their phones and no one was talking, or oh my god, I was in the park and no one was on their phone. No, every single time they've scientifically measured this, it's not even vaguely true. I'll give you an example. Recently a scientist wondered about this question of, okay, parks, you know, how many people are on their phones? And so they sat down and set up cameras at Bryant Park in New York City. And the reason why they picked that spot is because there was actually a great comparison point. Another sociologist, like 20 years earlier, before smartphones, recorded hours and hours and hours and hours of activity of what people did inside Bryant Park. So you could actually compare. You could say, okay, now that we have smartphones, how often are we just zoning out and looking at our smartphones, right? And so he does the same thing. He puts up a camera and he records hours and hours and hours, and he sits down with grad students and he looks at it like second by second. And this takes months and months to sift through. And what he finds is that the people who are actually looking at their smartphone are about 3 to 10% of the people out there. So an extremely small minority. And the same thing happens. I've started doing this in restaurants. I walk into a restaurant randomly, and I just go, okay, let's just, in this snapshot moment of time, I pull up my pad, I write down all the number of people, and I look at how many at that moment are looking at their phones. And I do this over and over again, and I consistently find pretty much it's the same minority, less than 10%. So why do we feel that this is happening, that this is a massive way that everyone is doing it? I think it's because of what scientists call a frequency illusion. Once we've decided something annoys us, or that we find something obnoxious, We just notice it more often, right? When we start focusing on it. So you walk into the cafe, you see the one kid who's on the phone, you're like, oh my God, everyone's doing it. And it's like, no, look up, look around, act like a scientist, look at the world around you.
Well, wouldn't we do the same thing if we liked something? So, I mean, if you like something, you're going to see it more frequently too. So even if you like talking on the phone, you could still see that it is there's been an increase in less social behavior.
I'm sorry, I don't think I quite follow that argument.
Okay, so I like, hypothetically, I like being on my smartphone, and I notice when I go out in public, more people are doing it, and I nod in satisfaction, you know? Yeah. But the point is that I would still have that, what was it, frequency of association.
I agree, but I'm specifically addressing. I mean, I'm specifically addressing the concern and the statement that people are always doing this. That is simply factually inaccurate, and we have to stop saying it. I mean, like, what we can say, if you wanted to be accurate, you could say there is a minority of people that do this a lot, and we should be careful about that because maybe it's going to grow. Maybe other people will take a social cue and say this. An acceptable thing to do. I think that that's a perfectly legitimate concern. But this lazy op-ed thinking that something has always happened to me is really just an absolute distortion of what's going on in the world around us. And in fact, I tell people, I say, do it. You know, take a piece of paper, and the next time you walk into a cafe, you know, and do this randomly. Don't pick a moment when you notice something. Just every time you go somewhere, pull out a pad. Take in that one, maybe even take a picture so you get an objective snapshot and look at what people are doing. And it's very interesting. It's much lower than you think it is. So the truth is, I simply don't buy that idea that we are getting locked off. And there's even other research that shows that the Pew Internet sat down, a correlation of face-to-face socializing. They look at teenagers, where theoretically this is absolutely off the hook, and teenagers don't know how to relate to one another, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they found, lo and behold, that the kids that did the most highest amount of text messaging also...
Hello? Oh, no. Technology. Okay. Oh, we dropped at a critical moment here. So while we have a slight intermission here, we want to encourage you to call in. We're speaking with Clive Thompson. And Clive Thompson is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Is technology improving your life and making you smarter in different ways? Call us and share your experiences.
In the meantime.
Good morning, Alex.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Well, you have to be patient here. But what was your question?
Well, my comment is when you're talking about the cell phone situation, the smartphones, it depends on every situation is different, but it also depends whether you're in a particular social situation. For example, if you're at a gathering and you're on your cell phone, well, there must be something wrong with that. But if you're just on the bus and you're on your smartphone, well, you know, is it really, do you really have to make friends or start a conversation with somebody? Well, it's up to every situation, like I said, that is different. It's up to how much time you're going to be spending on the bus, or it's up to anything, right? The point of that, if technology is making us smarter, I think it's making us in some way closer, and in some ways smarter, yes, because people are sharing more knowledge. But it's also like everything else. It depends on the type of information that we receive, and it depends on the type of information that we decide to believe, and it also depends on the network that we create with this technology as well.
Mm-hmm. That ties right in with something that you also say, Clive, with regard to collaborative thinking and sharing. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I mean, here's one of the things that's really interesting. That's the big change in the way that we keep contact with each other. So sociologists talk about strong links and weak links. And so strong links are the people we know incredibly well, like our spouses, our friends, our family. And you know, those are tight emotional connections. We rely on them a lot. We know them very well. They know us very well. There aren't very many of those strong links. We have a very small number because it takes a lot of time to, you know, to make those things strong. We spend a lot of time with those people. There's weak links. Those are people that we don't really know well at all. Like maybe you only see them once or twice a year. Someone you glance at the corner of your eye occasionally at work, or maybe someone you met at a cocktail party, or whatnot, or a person you knew from college a long time ago. Now, here's the funny thing. Weak links, on the one hand, you know, you're not relying on them for your emotional support. They're not a big part of your life. But they're incredibly important when it comes to finding things out that are new and interesting. When Marshall Granovetter did this study back in the 70s of how people found a job, he asked people, you know, who did word of mouth, you know, how did you find your job? And it turned out that the best jobs, the ones that paid the most and the one that had the most satisfaction, people found through a weak link. Through someone that they didn't know very well, someone they talked to maybe once or twice a year. Now, why is that? Why wouldn't your friends who know you the best be the ones that would refer you to an amazing job? Well, it's because your friends know the same information you do. You guys are soaking in the same information pool. They're not going to know anything. They're not going to know about a job that you haven't already heard of. Whereas the weak link, someone far off in a different field, they're stewing in information that's totally new and novel to you. And so this is the theory of weak links. Now, sociologists have known for a long time that weak links are amazing because they broker great new connections and information. But historically, it was hard for the average person like me to keep in touch with weak links because I'm not that social a person. I'm not going to pick up the phone and call, you know, 250 people I barely know just to sort of vaguely stay in touch throughout the year. I don't have that emotional bandwidth. But what starts happening when you have a world where it's easier to remain in lightweight connection with people through these status tools ranging from everything from Twitter to Facebook to Instagram is that you have much more exposure to the ideas and things that are going on, and you can reach out and connect with people who you actually don't even know at all, but you just share a particular common interest. And this is where some acts of fascinating collaborative thinking happen. Here's a funny one I'll give you. So I was at South by Southwest 2 days ago, and I was going to go on stage and I was going to talk. And at some point in time, I was going to mention the famous German writer and poet Goethe. But the funny thing is, I didn't know how to pronounce his name. I'd only ever read it. I was like pronouncing it like Gauss or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was dimly aware that, okay, I'm pronouncing this wrong, but I don't know how to pronounce it right. And oh my God, I've got 5 minutes and I'm going on stage and I'm going to look like a total idiot in front of these people. You know, like these are reasonably educated people. I'm going to look like the suburban Toronto kid that I actually am. So I went onto Twitter and I was like, help me out, people. How do you pronounce G-O-E-T-H-E correctly? Because I'm sure I'm mangling this. And so all these different people who, like, sort of, it got passed around, so it was kind of funny, and a few close friends were weighing in, but then a few German speakers, people who I don't really know that well, but just follow me, who speak fluent German, were like, here is how to do it, here is how to pronounce it like a German. And so there was this quick little problem solving that was only possible because I can connect with these weak links, these people who I don't know very well. And so these types of weak link problem solving things happen all the time, and this is one of the great strengths of our online world is the cultivation and the connection of weak links.
I want to get back to that, but we've got a caller here, and we'll go to Paul. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. How are you doing?
Just fine. How about you?
Good, good. So I had a question. I'm not clear as to whether the technology you're talking about is exclusively communication technology, you're talking about technology in general.
Right. You know, I'm talking, that's a good question. I'm really talking mostly about communication technology, because technology, like in general, includes everything from penicillin to robotics to nanotechnology, and that's a much, much larger question, right? And so, you know, like if you wanted to answer the question as to whether technology, qua technology, makes us smarter, you know, that's more variables than I can count. You know, on the one hand, maybe some stuff really does. You know, penicillin keeps us from dying. Not dying allows us to learn more. That's great. You know, the internal combustion engine, well, it's done some wonderful things, but it's also sort of cooking the planet. So that's a problem. So the answer is I'm looking specifically at the modes for communicating. I wish I'd been more clear in the title of my book, but there's only so long you can make a title of a book. It turns out.
I guess I'm not sure exactly then how you can really separate communication technologies from all other technologies, seeing as really they're all pretty darn interrelated at this point.
Well, I guess that's true, but I mean, you can definitely separate out technologies that really have nothing to do with communicating, and particularly nothing to do with personal communications, right? I mean, like I was focusing specifically on technologies that allow people to talk to one another and to communicate their ideas to one another, and you can definitely separate that out from other types of technologies. You know,
well, I'm not sure you can
How would you give an example of how you can't separate them?
That's what I was going to say. It's like because it requires the entire interlocking production, distribution, et cetera, system to allow these communication technologies to develop. It's an interrelated system. You can't separate them out.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for your call.
But wait. But I have my fundamental point was that if that's true, and that would require a greater conversation, whether or not you could actually separate these things out, and I'm not prepared to actually give you a really detailed argument on that right now, but if it's true, just for sake of argument, then you have to look at the larger context of technologies as to whether how intelligent they really are and what the real goal of intelligence is. If intelligence is for survival, then you could say that it actually isn't all that intelligent, that the cumulative impact of all the technologies we've developed are actually heading us in a potentially very disastrous direction. So I guess that's my fundamental point.
Thank you, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask a question to a point you were making earlier about weak links, and in terms of how it might be helpful in terms of making a stronger or making connections. One thing that some people have observed is that although we have all the social media and these connections, that in fact we are only talking to ourselves. So so you know, liberal Democrats talk to liberal Democrats, read liberal websites, and go on and on. The same thing with conservatives or people who basket weaves. Is it possible for us to get outside of our own circles so that we actually communicate with those who are different? Or is this just something that has always been the case and it just magnified by technology today?
Yeah. This is an excellent question. Because the concern is, and I think this is a real concern, is that when it comes to specifically like political sites online, you know, if you visit them, it can often really feel like a real echo chamber, you know, where people are showing up so that they can, basically just agree with each other, so that they can reinforce each other by giving it sort of, here's more evidence that proves that we're right, you know, even if that evidence is kind of wrong. And that happens on all sides of all political sides. And I do think that's a genuine danger and problem. We've always had the problem of it's called homophily, like the birds of a feather flock together. Physically, people move to neighborhoods where there are other people demographically and politically like them. So you see homophily a lot in everyday life, and you would have sort of hoped that the internet would have allowed people to break outside of those silos, right? But when you look at these political sites, you think, not so much. You know, it really seems to be just a big love fest where no one's really challenging everyone else. But here's the interesting thing. There are actually many, many, many places online where people of diverse political views gather together, but they aren't sites devoted to politics. There's a guy named Joseph Kahane, and he's done fantastic studies of what you could call sort of interest groups, which is just like almost like, you know, pick your hobby. You know, I mean, I'm into sort of, you know, snowboarding. I'm into sailing. I'm into knitting. I'm into guitar pedals, right? Mm-hmm. And so people love to hunt down their hobbies online. And, you know, you pick whatever it is, and there's some board with 10,000 people. For me, actually, I am into guitar pedals and origami, and so I frequent all these discussion boards, and friends of mine who are really into knitting go to Ravelry. And now here's the funny thing. When you're in those sites, people are there because they're interested in a common interest. It's a common subject. But because they're there for a long time, they start talking about all sorts of stuff. And one of the fascinating things is in those sites, you see all sorts of political conversations emerge, and they are way more civil and polite and nuanced, because people are there because they already respect each other, because, you know, we're all origami people, we're all knitting people, right? And they actually have much more productive conversations. The secret seems to be get people to talk about politics in situations that are not devoted to politics.
Right.
Because when people go to political sites, they go there with, you know, to grind their axe. And when they go somewhere else and they meet people and they have fun with them and they're really, you know, vibing with them, because, you know, we're all here because we all love this particular cooking thing. When the subject drifts to politics, they are much more considered, and they're much more willing to regard the other person as a human. And that's where much more interesting dialogue happens. So if you wanted my answer, I would say shut down all the political sites and the other thing I would say, frankly, I think a lot of newspapers should shut off their comment threads.
Oh, well, most definitely. And, you know, and that's an excellent demonstration of what you refer to as weak links, because the platforms that you mentioned, the forums, those have developed stronger links and links of consideration and respect, whereas these others have no linkage at all, and you feel quite comfortable spilling your guts and showing your nether parts.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Here's the interesting thing about conversation online, is that it really is exactly like conversation offline, which is to say, if there isn't someone who's doing the work of the host and rewarding good behavior and punishing bad behavior, and if there isn't a sense of cohesion that the people in the room know who each other roughly are, you don't have a good conversation. You just got a mob of people. And so, like, any situation where there is a, you know, where there is that sense of cohesion and there's hostly people doing that work, you get great stuff. Newspapers never, ever, ever satisfy those conditions. They're just trying to attract page views. They just want to get as many people clicking on that page as possible. They don't pay for any staff to engage with the commenters and sort of and encourage the people who are being smart and discourage the idiots and kick them off. And so you wind up with just a terrible mess. And I tell every newspaper, look, if you are not going to do the social work necessary to unlock the value of that community, then you should just shut it down, because you're doing damage to society, frankly, if you ask me.
Well, you know, one of the damages, and I want to get your opinion on this, is how do we prevent when we're trying to do collaborative thinking and problem solving, how do we avoid the folly à deux, you know, or the confirmation bias? You know, there's that groupthink that we can fall into as human beings. And you've mentioned that sometimes hobby forums are one way to do it, but so many pieces of information on the internet are somebody's opinion. If you want to know, for example, how to pronounce Goethe, and you type it into ask.com, you better hope that most of those people have a clue. And they're not going to tell you, that's Goethe.
Well, no, absolutely. Or Gouda.
Well, exactly.
I mean, the short answer is never, ever go to ask.com and never, ever go to
But I mean, you know, knowing how to choose sites.
Sites are just dreadful. I mean, but here's an interesting question that you throw to that. So when you look at question answering sites that try and offer, you know, some sort of wisdom, you discover that the variety is enormously huge. So you have Yahoo Answers, which is just dreadful. I mean, my God, you show up and the quality of the answers is terrible. And Ask is just as bad. On the other hand, you have places like Quora, where people actually post these incredibly thoughtful answers. They're a lot longer. In fact, the average answer I went to ask them is like 500 or 600 words long. It's not coughing up a sentence. They're offering real evidence and whatnot. They're incredibly high quality. And you're like, so how did they do that? And once again, it comes down to actually creating an architecture that encourages good behavior and discourages bad behavior. They have, you cannot post to Quora at all unless you are logged in under a confirmable identity. And then after that, there's reputational stuff. If you are someone who generates a really good answer, people are able to vote on that one, and the vote is attached to your identity. So overall, you get a better ranking. So that when you go on in to answer something, and I've read several academic studies that show that the people respond to these systems very positively. It tends to attract people who want to actually be helpful, and it tends to drive away the cranks who are just there to say something stupid because they frankly don't want to have to fight through the difficulty of being subject to a ranking system. So you look at Quora. Quora is amazing, and that's because they worked hard at creating a structure. And this is the thing we're learning over and over again, is that this is not like just build it and they will come when it comes to creating a really good intellectual environment online. You have to pay attention to the lessons of what works and what doesn't work. I'll give you another quick example. Remember during the Boston bombing last year?
Yes.
So there was this Reddit thread, and Reddit is this huge, very unruly discussion board. Mm-hmm. And they decided, okay, we're gonna use this amazing crowd solving to figure out who these guys were, and they got it totally wrong.
Yes.
Because someone put up a couple photos and said, I think this is them. And then everyone started upvoting those and going, oh yeah, this is right, this is right, this is right. And you had that classic problem. And you have this problem in offline group thing too. You talk to any corporation, people who go into a room, and they're 20 of them, and okay, we're gonna come up with some great ideas. And what happens is the first loudest expressed opinion, because everyone just goes, okay, that's great, and they all rally behind that idea no matter how dumb it is. So this is a problem we've wrestled with in the offline world. Well, so how do you design around that? How do you make a system that instead of creating the idiocy of crowds, catalyzes the actual wisdom of crowds? You could actually take some cues from what we know about offline groupthink, because people who've studied, like face-to-face groupthink and they've recognized this problem, that someone says something loudly and it's dumb, but everyone rallies behind it. How do you avoid that? Well, you do this thing that's called distributed or virtual brainstorming. You say to everyone, okay, we're going to have a brainstorming meeting, but I want you to sit alone at your desk for 15 or 20 minutes or half an hour, and I want you to come up with 5 ideas or 4 ideas before you come to the meeting. And then everyone's going to come to the meeting, and so everyone's got stuff to contribute, and they're not just going to shut up because someone else is really loud. They actually have to get all their ideas out. And this tends to break down that problem of the first loud answer being the one that everyone agrees to. And you can do the same thing at Reddit. In fact, Reddit is now looking at creating a system. If anyone wants to do one of these groupthink projects, let's figure out this thing. There's a news, a fast-moving news story. We're going to try and group solve it. They want to implement a sort of staggered timing on voting. So what you could think of it like this. Someone puts up a couple of photos saying, I think these are the bombers, but you're not allowed to vote on it for 15 minutes because you have to have that time to think about it and read other things and think about it on your own before you actually cast your vote. So you can't just have these cascades of stupidity happening. The trick with collaboration online, like as collaboration offline, is that you have to be able to communicate to other people and see what they're saying, but you have to preserve your own judgment also. And that can be designed, that can be created. So that's kind of these are the things we're learning as we watch what works and what doesn't.
We're speaking this morning with Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. One of the things that was a very important, that played an important role in my life was when I was 6 years old, and my dad took me to the library to get my library card. And one thing that wasn't so important for me was there was this place with all these books, and if I had questions, I could go to the librarian and engage with conversations, and she could point me to, the right section of the library. So the question is related, is the library losing that type of role when we can Google everything or go to ask.com? How are public libraries transforming themselves to stay up with the smart technology?
Yeah, this is an amazing question, because you're absolutely right. They are definitely, I think, libraries are losing the role of the place where you go to find a simple answer to a simple question. And in one sense, this is a historic trend that librarians have been wrestling with for 150 or actually 400 years, which is every time a new technology comes along, they have to change not just how they do what they do, but what they do in the first place. In fact, when public libraries first emerged a few hundred years ago, the librarian's job was merely to go and get you the book. And that was because there was no Dewey Decimal System. So when they acquired books, they had no method for organizing it. Often they just put them on the shelf in the order that they bought them. And so the librarian was the only person that knew where the book was. You and I were not allowed to go and grab the books ourselves. Mm. So the sole job of the librarian, the only thing they did, was for me to walk up and go, can I get that book? And they would walk back and, using their memory, find that book and bring it to me. And that you needed librarians because there was no organization principle at all. They were the organizing principle, and that took all of their time, 24 hours a day, right?
So Clive, did that include the process of archiving? Because you do speak a lot about that.
Yeah. No, yeah. Like, their entire job was finding the books to buy and putting them there. But what I'm saying is basically the librarian's job was, like, the librarian did not do any question answering. The librarian did not do any consultation. The librarian was literally a machine that located the book for you, right? That bought the books and stored them. Now, once the Dewey Decimal System came along, Melville Dewey was like, wait a minute, I want people to be able to go and grab the book themselves. And he figured out how to organize libraries, and lo and behold, suddenly librarians didn't need to go and grab the book for us anymore. And they had to figure out a completely new role. And they started realizing, well, our new job is going to be actually helping people answer questions, right? We're going to be the person that, when you can't figure out what book to go for, we're going to guide you to that book. So now that we actually have other ways to answer questions, all the librarians I talk to across the country are realizing, okay, we have to redefine what we're doing now. And the new role, and this is a really interesting new role, is teaching people how to search and how to look for information intelligently. Because no one really knows how to, there's nothing intuitive about how to be a good searcher online. You have to be taught this. And no one has been taught this. Like, for the last 10 years, we've sort of been left to, fend for ourselves. And the curriculum in school doesn't actually make this a thing that kids should learn, which is nuts, because you would think this should be a central thing they're teaching. So the librarians have all realized that their new role is in essentially teaching people how to sort of, how to become adept searchers, how to learn the online environment, how to learn the offline environment, and that is their new role. But here's the other thing that's really cool about libraries, is that as a physical space, they are still incredibly valuable. And I get so annoyed when I hear people say, oh, the libraries are not going to be necessary anymore, because libraries are still fantastic locuses for communities, for community information, and it's still important to have a physical place to go to interact with those librarians and to interact with the physical books, which are not going away. We're going to have physical books for a long time. But here's the last wonderful thing about libraries.
Well, hold on for just a second, because we got a couple of callers, so let me see if I can squeeze them in.
Yeah, no problem. Shut up.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. It's Joe. Hilarious that you bring up libraries, because I work at a library too, and I have a lot of things to say about that, but it wasn't actually my question. My question was kind of riffing off of where Paul's question had ended up, in pointing interlocking systems of production and the assumptions of behind communications technology.
Yes.
And I just wanted to suggest that, maybe we can think of the anxieties that people have around technology have to do with the proprietary relationship that we often are only allowed to have with technology. We have to buy into these telecommunication corporations. We have to work for a living to pay them for access to this technology. And
we're not even sure that they're giving us proper access for what we pay.
Sure. That's not even bringing up net neutrality concerns.
Mm-hmm. So one of the points that our caller Joe is alluding to is privacy and a measure of sovereignty, I guess.
Autonomy.
Yes, autonomy and sovereignty. Mm-hmm.
This is an amazing point because she's absolutely right. I mean, the original vision of the internet was not at all the corporate mess that we currently have, right? Like, the original vision of the internet was that, you know, people would be communicating with each other in more of what they call a peer-to-peer fashion. So, mm-hmm. you know, my computer, which I own and run myself, would be talking to yours and to other people's one-on-one, and we would not have these massive corporations like Facebook and Google and everyone sitting in the middle and hoovering up all of our data or being the place that stores all of our utterances. That there would be much more autonomy in this regard. And they also sort of envisioned that, you know, the pipelines would not be so metered and profit taken out in rent by the corporations that own them. In practical reality, unfortunately, what has happened is that it's become increasingly corporatized as time goes on. There's really only like 5 or 6 corporations that own all of the pipelines that all the internet runs on. And given its incredible importance as a public asset, you start to think, this is sort of nuts, you know? Like, we have public ownership of the roads. They're not privatized. Why is it that we've taken this incredibly important civic forum and said this runs entirely over corporate pipelines, you know? So if you ask me, I think there should be much stronger regulations in favor of net neutrality. We should not be weakening this. We should be strengthening this, because we can't, you know, at the moment, we can't turn back the clock. Those pipelines are all owned by corporations, but they effectively have a monopoly on that.
Well, they'll also squash the opportunities for collaborative thinking. And we have one more caller we're going to try to squeeze in. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. This truly isn't a proper dialogue, what you're having here.
Say that again?
This isn't truly a dialogue, what we're having here now.
Oh, okay.
The caller before the last caller, that man has the capacity to have the dialogue.
Yes.
Okay, so listen to this. So do this. On your supercomputer, use the technology for this. On your supercomputer right now, tell us what Einstein said about technology before this program.
Hello? Bye.
What's that?
Look up on your supercomputer now what Einstein said about technology.
He said quite a lot of different things about technology. Some were incredibly negative and some were incredibly negative and some were incredibly
look
positive.
It up on...
Okay, caller, we don't have a lot of time, so if you could cut to the chase and share your thought with us,
look
that would really help.
Look it up on the computer right now and tell everybody listening on the whole planet what Einstein said.
Okay, well, thank you for your point. You know, it's not that the callers who've talked about the interlocking nature of technology and whether we're making good choices or bad choices with the type of technologies we're devising, it's not that they don't have a point. It's just slightly off target, because we're talking about the communication technologies more commonly characterized by social medias and search engines and what have you. That's not to say that these callers don't have a point. They're just off target.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the point that they've all raised, which I think is absolutely correct, is that these tools have they're all built by corporations. Usually, they're built by corporations that are trying to sell ads to us. And this is one thing that is my big critique of the way we currently connect online, is that these corporate tools can deform the way this collaboration and public speech happens.
Yes.
Because you know, when the whole goal is to sell ads, well, then that, first off, that means that they want people to be constantly addicted to and checking their service, right? They want to be more distracted. That's not good. There are a bunch of reasons, but the point is, this is not the only way these that this sharing can happen. I recently, just experimentally, set up a home server so I could run my own social network and my own cloud sharing stuff off on the 7-year-old computer that sits underneath my kitchen. This took me 15 minutes, and it was free to do, basically. Mm-hmm. And so this is the beginnings, and we're going to see more and more of this. What I hope will happen is, you know, the decentralization of the internet, people realizing we can just do this stuff ourselves. We could really build a much more community-based internet, and we don't need these massive corporations that are scooping up our data and allowing the NSA to grab a hold of it. That that is a much more humanistic future that would actually address, that would allow us to get all the good things we get from these communications without being subject to the commercial and corporate dictates.
And that would be a great point to have another conversation with you, Clive. Thank you so much for your time. This is More Talk. We'll be talking to you again soon. This is More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Coming up at 9 a.m., the Old Mole Variety Hour at 10. Eric Cascady is off today, so we'll hear an excerpt from Between the Lines. 10:15, Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. 11 o'clock brings Dr. David Naiman and Health Watch. 11:30, Health and Healthcare Forum with Roberta Hall. All this and more because you support Your Community Connection. KBOO Portland lets us build some community here.
KBOO is sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
You are listening to KBOO FM Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. I'm Tom Becker, Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate-owned conventional news media. Today on our program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Young Nam, a social studies teacher in Portland Public High Schools. They will be discussing why high-stakes testing is being used to destroy U.S. education and how we can build a really engaging, stimulating schools in which kids not only learn facts, but learn how to think and come to love learning. The productivity of the U.S. worker continues to grow while wages stagnate. I'll be sharing an article by Jeffrey McDonald entitled, "The Revolving Door of Unemployment, Is Growth a Cure for the Consequences of Growth?" Bill Resnick will return with some thoughts on the crises currently gripping the Ukraine. Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker will conclude our program with another segment in their ongoing Left in the Law series. They'll be talking about an important recent Texas law ruling. Elvia, a 40-year-old death row inmate in Texas, was scheduled to be executed by lethal injection on January 15, 2014. But his execution was stayed based on groundbreaking new Texas law, the only one of its kind in the nation, which recognizes that scientific experts often get it wrong. Mike and Jan talk about the significance of this Texas statute for criminal defendants convicted on the basis of what is known as junk science. But now here is Bill talking with Young Nam, a Portland social studies teacher.
Young Nam, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill.
Young Nam teaches at Wilson High School several years ago, and it was a protracted struggle. He got in trouble with the school administration. It was about high-stakes testing for his students. Young Nam, tell us about your effort, how you challenged high-stakes testing, what happened. Then we discuss why you did it, and then we can get to what the alternatives are for curriculum, for pedagogy, for teaching to the high-stakes testing model.
The basic issue was that, you know, we're losing more and more of our teaching time to testing our students, and it just began with asking some questions to administrators and to the central admin who just refused to give me a rationale for what we were doing that really made sense. And I can't even remember now what ultimately got me into trouble, but it was basically asking questions about, you know, limiting teachers' academic freedom, losing time to testing, and such kinds of issues that ended up getting me in trouble.
And I guess talking to other teachers about it, they really did want to shut you up from, in fact, even critiquing the testing program.
Sure, yeah. Just sending out emails from things like New York Times articles talking about how the SAT is not really a reliable predictor of student success in college and things like that that you would think would be relevant for educators to share ideas about and discuss. They wanted to shut me down and say that I couldn't send emails to my colleagues.
And there was also a struggle about bringing people into the class.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I heard that they had, at a middle school, some teachers invited people from the Occupy Portland education panel to come speak. And before the speakers even arrived, or right as the speakers were arriving, the principal refused to allow them into the classroom to speak. So I and several colleagues started a petition saying that teachers' academic freedom needs to be protected. And also, we wrote the people in central admin and human resources, and they did not have a justification for what they're doing. And I was just pointing out the hypocrisy of that when, you know, they let everyone from military recruiters to people from corporations and junior achievement come speak in classrooms all the time and never question that. Yet, people from the Portland Occupy Portland education panel was considered too controversial and would need prior parental approval before they would be allowed to speak.
Basically, you sort of won both of those battles. They were unable to shut you up, but it was frightening for a while, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was willing to put myself at risk because they just were not being accountable. And if it means that I get into trouble to have an opportunity to get them to speak publicly about these issues that they haven't been willing to respond to me about, would be great.
Young, let's get into your challenge to testing. In fact, it's continued. When you began, there was a lot of teacher questioning and opposition to testing. Well, the testing has gotten worse, and teacher opposition, you were sort of a lonely voice at the beginning, or at least you were one of the first to speak up. Now it seems to me that the opposition to testing, especially as it becomes more and the stakes of it get greater and greater, now that opposition has intensified and borne some fruit in the recent contract, not as much as any people would want, but some. And it raised the question of